This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of the Naz and Wally Sports Hour, heard Sunday mornings at 9 on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
The world doesn't need another sports show. It needs an awesome sports show. You're listening to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Good morning, Naz. Good morning, Wally. The boys are back. Let's talk sports.
Good morning and welcome to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour. I'm your host, Walter Rigabon. As usual with me, my co-host, Naz Marchese. Good morning, Naz. How are you?
Good, Wally. How are you?
I'm good. I haven't seen you in a while, brother, so it's been...
The beard's back on. I shaved a bit, and the beard's back on.
So. No, I have not been growing a COVID-19 beard. I've been shaving almost every morning. My son's got one that his mother wants him to shave off. So I haven't seen you in a while. We've been doing this remotely. I'm up in Richmond Hill. You're up in Nobleton, and... We'll keep it going. Hopefully, I see you again in studio pretty soon. Hopefully, we can get into this. Got a shout out to all the mothers today. It's Happy Mother's Day, Naz. All the best to Mary Lane. I know your mom's passed on. I have very fond memories of your mom and, of course, of your dad from our youth when I used to come over. We used to. Spent a lot of time in your basement and your living room watching hockey, watching sports. So I have tremendous memories of your mom. My mom, I'm still fortunate. She's still with us. I'm part of the COVID-19 thing. I'm not actually able to see her in live today. She's in a long-term care facility, so we're going to head over this afternoon and do the wave through the window thing. So to all the moms out there and to my wife and to your wife, Naz, and all the mothers, a happy Mother's Day.
Couldn't have said it any better.
Means more this year than it ever has in a lot of different ways. On the show today, we're thrilled. Brian Burke. Actually thrilled to interview him. I don't think I've prepared as much for an interview as I have for the Brian Burke interview. He's a pretty bright guy and pretty accomplished. So I have a feeling he's going to keep us on our toes today. So I have a whole long list, a laundry list of questions I want to ask him. And I know you do as well, Naz. And it's appropriate at this time, as we usually do, a shout out to all the people who are providing essential services, doctors, nurses, responders, policemen, fire chiefs and fire people, firefighters, I couldn't get the words out, truck drivers, grocery store clerks. So many of us are on the front lines of this. I feel privileged. I'm not on the front lines, but I do have admiration and respect for those that have to work, choose to work, who are personal service workers, people working in long-term care facilities. So many of them, Naz, that we owe so much to that are trying to keep our society functioning. They're doing a great job, and we owe them so much. So once again, as we do every Sunday morning, a shout-out to all the people who are keeping us going.
I'd like to do a shout-out also to Jillian Herring and Rose Gugletti from Amica Thornhill Seniors Lifestyle. Zero positive tests in that facility. That's an amazing job for them.
Yeah, man. On that note, a shout-out to the good people at Pine Grove as well, where my mom is. These are difficult times, and the facilities that take care of our most vulnerable are under really, really, really trying circumstances. And to all those people working in those facilities who are putting their lives at risk on a daily basis, thank you much. Thank you so much. So, Naz, thank you for pointing that out. And, of course, important to recognize all the people in those facilities. It's certainly been a trying time, and for them trying to protect our seniors, the ones that have built our country, the ones we owe so much to. We keep our fingers crossed.
On a brighter note, it looks like the golf courses are going to be opening soon, Wally.
For the email from Club Link, I'm expecting it almost on a daily basis. I got my foursome ready, Naz. the first day, I will be lined up, ready to go. They have a whole new social distancing protocol for golf courses. It's certainly a place I think we can practice our sport and do it in a safe manner. We keep away from each other. They have special rules about the cups and putting your hand in the cup. That won't be allowed. Certainly looking forward to that, Naz. On that note, we have Brian Burke, and I think we should get to him as soon as we possibly can. We'll take the break, and we'll get Brian Burke on the phone.
It was a rainy day when Pizzaville introduced contact-free delivery. Order and prepay online and choose contact-free delivery. The driver will place your order on your doorstep in a nice, clear, protective bag. Then he'll politely stand back 2 metres and call the number on the receipt. Once you answer the door, he'll give you a little toodaloo and off he goes. Contact-free delivery from pizzaville.ca or the Pizzaville app.
Are you real ready? If you're a real estate agent, we can help you sell more homes. A business owner? We'll help show it off to the community at large. And if you're a homeowner, we'll supply accurate floor plans for every room in your home. Because selling property is all in the details. Real Tours Media, creators of 3D virtual tours, walkthrough video, HDR photography, logos, and brands. Check out the one-stop shop for successful real estate agents. RealToursMedia.ca.
With a little training, anyone can learn the security business while on duty at your home or company. It's unfortunate, but a lot of security companies are just not experienced enough to handle the complex dynamics of tactical security. And that little bit of training and experience can end up costing you a lot more than you bargained for. Peace of mind, trust, and honor is the foundation on which the Regal Security reputation is built. They're driven, they're respected, and they're unrivaled. They're everyday superheroes. Visit them online at regalsecurity.ca and find out how much they know, not how much they can learn.
To become a champion in business, it takes coaching, training, and bench strength. And every team needs a skilled player like KPMG Enterprise for private companies. KPMG Enterprise helps entrepreneurs and family businesses grow, strengthen, and transition by offering a full suite of services, including audit, accounting, tax, and advisory. Your business doesn't stand still. It evolves. Team up with a winner. Visit kpmg.ca/enterprise. Let's do this.
There's an old saying, entrepreneurship doesn't build character, it reveals character. Entrepreneurs learn to trust a person by trusting people. The law firm Rigabon Carly understands this. They know all about entrepreneurs because they work for them. Every day, they've earned their trust. They know that when it comes to meeting the legal and business needs of entrepreneurs, good enough is not enough. Rigabon Carly, the intelligent choice.
This is Daryl Sittler for Alta Infinity and Vaughan. I've worked with some pretty great teams over the years, and the staff at Alta ranks among the very best. Expert sales, superior service, and the largest selection of Infinity cars and SUVs in Canada, and the most competitive pricing anywhere. It's no wonder that Alta has been an all-star performer for well over a decade. Visit AltaInfinityWoodbridge.com, or better yet, drop by the No. 7 Auto Mall at the corner of Martin Grove and Highway 7. Experience the difference that makes Alta Infinity the captain's choice.
The only thing I love more than sports is sports radio. Take it away, boys. The Naz and Wally Sports Hour on Zoomer Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour. Pleased to welcome to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour, Brian Burke. Good morning, Brian. How are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
We're great. Thanks so much for joining us, Brian. Just to let you know, we're doing this remotely. I'm in Richmond Hill. Naz is in Nobleton, so you're sort of stuck in the middle with us. So you'll be getting shots from the right and the left here. Not shots. We have the highest respect for your work and your career. And I'd like to get into it with you really quickly. The one thing I've admired most about you, Brian, amongst a bunch of a lot of other things, certainly accomplished. The one thing I've admired most about you is you always made community service an important part of your credo, in the sense that you thought important that sports organizations, that players, that management be parts of their community and contribute to their communities. And I always thought that that was a really great policy to have. Brian, share that with us.
Well, thank you, first of all. It's one of the things that is very important to me personally and on a professional level. And it's not just altruistic or philanthropic on my part. It's also part of a very sophisticated approach to marketing your team. And I had three pillars when I ran my teams. One was to run it like a business. And whenever I speak publicly and I say that, people are like, well, of course you run it like a business. No, a lot of pro sports teams are not run like a business. A lot of owners run their teams on principles that are counter to anything they would do in any other business. And I've said this before, a lot of owners make billions in one industry and then proceed to do exactly the opposite when they get a sports team. So number one is run it like a business. Number two is play an entertaining style. My teams were fun to watch. We hit, we fought, we traded chances. I didn't want to trap. I didn't want to be boring. But number three was community service. And in my mind, and I proved this, we started selling out in Vancouver long before we started winning, because we were entertaining. We ran it like a business. And then third was community service. People saw our players in the community. They appreciated that, and they started supporting the team.
Yes.
Brian, you've been in charge of three Canadian franchises, Vancouver, Toronto, Calgary, and two American clubs, Hartford and Anaheim. Which one was the most difficult to run and why?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I only lasted a year in Hartford. The owner and I did not see eye to eye by the end of the year, so I moved on to the league, so that couldn't be number one. There is something special about your first team, though. There is something special about your first GM job. I'll never forget that team. I loved living in Hartford. I really loved the guys. That was the toughest team I ever had, tougher than Anaheim. And I loved living in Hartford. People were great there. But then moving on, my favorite place to live was Calgary, because the people were so nice. It's so beautiful. And going back to the first question, everyone in Calgary is involved with a charity. Like, you meet someone. This struck me my first week living there. What do you do? Oh, I work for Grant Thornton, and I'm on the board of Special Olympics. What do you do? Oh, I work for ESSO, and I'm on the board of Big Brothers Big Sisters. Everybody in Calgary gives back. I've never worked anywhere like that. It's crazy. It was great. As far as the hockey experience, it's hard to beat the two tours of duty I did in Vancouver, because both times when I worked for Pat from 87 to 92, and then when I went back, both times the team got steadily better and the community rallied behind us. It was like being the king. The most fun professionally was Anaheim, because we won it. You know, you get a chance to hoist the cup over your head, and it's special. It's like climbing Mount Everest.
Brian, one word that always comes up in your evaluation of players over the years is character. Character is important to you. Always has been. And you grew up in a family of 10 kids, dad, mom. I think you're born in Providence, moved to Minnesota. And there's an interesting story. Your dad, I'd like you to share with our listeners, and it stuck with you for, I guess, forever. In quotation marks, I think your dad taught you a lesson at one time that life isn't always fair. Tell us that story.
Yeah, I remember my dad, I got cut from a team, and I started very late. I didn't start playing hockey till I was 13. So my first year of hockey was Bantam. And my second year, I got cut from the midget B or bantam B team. And I remember saying to my dad, I was really disappointed because I'd worked so hard, and I remember complaining to my dad. I said, "That's not fair." And my dad said to me, "Well, why? Whoever told you life was fair? Whoever told you life was fair, or was going to be fair, or that you're entitled to fairness? You're not entitled to assume that. You got to work your hardest, do your best, and then good things will happen." So I've never forgotten that. My dad was not a stern guy, but he was stern that day. He was kind of like, "What are you smoking? Who said life's fair? Life isn't fair. And life, you'll get as many breaks as you create for yourself, working hard, positioning yourself the right way, knowing the right people, doing things the right way. That's how life is fair. And if you don't do all those things, life isn't fair. And it's not fair sometimes anyway. I can tell you, as a parent who lost a kid, life isn't fair all the time.
Brian, here are two names I would like you to comment on and what they meant to you, your career. Gary Bettman and Pat Quinn.
Well, there's four guys that I talk about when I talk about mentors. One was my dad. My dad was a wonderful man, and I miss him every day. The other one you left out was Lou Lamorello, who I played for in Providence and was a wonderful influence on me for 4 years. But the two you mentioned, Pat Quinn, I worked for Pat for 5 years. I guess the best compliment I can give about Pat Quinn is that I wanted to be Pat Quinn. I tried to emulate all the good things about him. I didn't manage to do that. There was only one Pat Quinn, but I sure took on a lot of his qualities. Pat was big on a couple things. One was fairness. Talked about fairness all the time. He said, "We don't owe anyone a promotion. We don't owe anyone a player a captaincy. What we do owe every employee here is fairness. They have to be treated fairly, and they have to perceive that they're being treated fairly." And that lesson stuck with me and still does to this day. The other thing was, Pat was a great listener, and I tried to acquire that skill unsuccessfully, as it turns out. I'm still more interested in what I have to say sometimes, and I still interrupt. But Pat Quinn would let you talk for an hour and never interrupt. So, wonderful man, tough, fair, smart. I wished I could be Pat Quinn when I was younger, and I hope I took on some of his attributes. Gary Bettman. His image in Canada is not good, and it breaks my heart. He's a brilliant guy. He's a great guy. He's a great family guy. He's tough as nails. He's even smarter. And it was a pleasure working for him and an honor. And I view it like going to Harvard Business School, working for Gary Bettman for 5 years, like getting an MBA from Harvard.
Fascinating part, Brian. I think you're only the second. We've been on the air 5.5 years in this incarnation of the Nazanwali Sports Hour. I think you're only the second graduate of Harvard that we've ever interviewed. The other one that I can remember is Marv Levy, the former coach of the Buffalo Bills. And I think the only graduate from the Harvard Law School. You had an LSAT north of 700, which for non-lawyers, was considered a brilliant score in the 1970s. Certainly in the high, I think the high top 1.5 percentile. From what I've read, you barely prepared for the LSAT, which is that examination. Tell us what Harvard was like. The great movie in the 1970s for guys going to law school was Paper Chase. I don't know if you remember watching that before you went to Harvard. It featured a cantankerous professor called Professor Kingsfield. Don't know if you watched Paper Chase. I suspect that you did. Your recollections of Harvard Law School, and how close was it to the movie, or describe any significant professors that you remember?
Well, when I went there, John Houseman, I think, was the professor.
John Houseman is correct.
And, when they did the typecasting, or when they put the character together, one of the principal characters was Professor Clark Bice, B-Y-S-E. And I had Professor Bice for contracts when I was a one-out, my first year. And it was just like the movie. If you weren't prepared, you were asked to leave the class. They have a seating chart with your picture on it. You have an assigned seat. So it's not like you can hide very easily. And he was very intimidating and very demanding, but he was a great professor too. Wonderful, wonderful teacher. Just a very stern and demanding guy. And if you weren't prepared, if he turned to you and said, Mr. Burke, I want the facts of Hawkins versus McGee. You had better have done the reading and better be able to recite the facts in a concise fashion, or you were asked to leave. I didn't like Harvard. I thought it was too much like that, too intimidating, when it could have been a better learning experience. I think it's better now. I've lectured there a few times since I got out. I think it's better now. But when people ask me where I went to school, I say Providence College. I'm very proud of playing hockey at Providence College for Lou Lamoriello. I am a Friar, which is the school name, the team name. And I never say I went to Harvard. People have to pry that out of me.
Yes. Brian, there's one question to lighten it up a bit. Why do you rarely tie your tie?
Well, I wish there was a more interesting statement about that. People always ask me if I was trying to make a fashion statement. I'm like, I'm from Minnesota. I wanted 10 kids. I'm not smart enough to make a fashion statement. It was never important in our house. I mean, good Lord. I went to college with two hockey bags, and one of them was full of hockey equipment. That's all I took to college. It cracked me up when I was driving my daughters back to school to start the school year. They had refrigerators and stereos, and I had two hockey bags, and one of them was mostly hockey equipment. The other one, I had a suit coat. I had one suit. My dad made me buy a suit for my or a suit coat and nice pants for my recruiting tour in the fall. I had a couple of suit coats. I think I got a suit at some point, not that first year maybe, and then some clothes. I had like 10 shirts, underwear, and three pairs of jeans. That was it. And so the tie thing comes from, I used to go to work when I worked for Pat at 5:30 in the morning. I was in the office by 6 every day. So when the Toronto Maple Leafs were open for business at 9 a.m., so were the Vancouver Canucks. Pat would come in between 7 and 7:15. I would roll out of bed and come into work in jeans and a t-shirt. And I kept all my work clothes at work. So Pat would roll into work about 7:15, dressed immaculately. He was a great dresser. And we would meet in his office. And some days the meeting would be 20 minutes. Some days it would be an hour. Because I had to fill him in. I did most of the grunt work, you know, the amateur scouting, pro scouting, all the staff contracts, all the player contracts. So I would give him an update on where I was. You know, I'm trying to sign David Bruce. Here's where we are on the money. And Pat had complete control over everything. He had his fingertips on everything. He'd say, okay, you can bump the offer this. I'd say, I'm having a problem with this team doctor. And he'd say, all right, I'll talk to him. We'd go through the whole thing. I'd get my assignments for the day. Sometimes that meeting lasted 20 minutes. Sometimes it was an hour. Then I would go downstairs and work out. So I'd run on the treadmill or ride the bike, shower, shave, and put on a suit. I would never tie the tie downstairs because it was just a waste of time. So I started going upstairs, hanging up my suit coat, and going to work. And I wouldn't tie the tie until I had my first meeting. And a lot of days, that wasn't until the game, until a warm-up. So then I stopped tying it all together. It's just sheer laziness. So there's not a great story behind it. It's more laziness than anything.
Brian, you co-manager of 5 NHL teams. You've probably dealt with a lot of player agents over the years. Which ones would you describe as being really good at their craft and why?
Well, I don't think negotiating contracts is a good use of a GM's time. I really don't. It's very aggravating. There's a lot of time that goes into minor moves. So when I was an assistant GM, I did every player contract in Vancouver. And then when I went to Hartford, I did every player contract because I was new. And then when I went back to Vancouver, I did every player contract, I think, the first summer, and then I gave it over to Dave Nonis. So I don't think it's a good use of time. Like, even a minor league contract, even a good minor leaguer, you're talking 3-4 hours total on the phone before you get the deal done. 4 hours where you could be trying to make trades and make your team better. So I haven't done player contracts in a long time. I wouldn't opine on the current state of affairs in the NHL, who's good, who's not. Back in the day, I had some notable battles with Pat Morris, who I thought was very professional, very good. Donnie Meehan and that group, Newport Sports. I'm so old, I remember dealing with Gus Padale and Bill Waters, and, you know, I go back a long way. Art Kaminsky. So I wouldn't opine as to who's good or who's not right today, but I don't think it's a good use of a GM's time. To me, it's like, that's why you have an analytics guy. It's not a good use of a GM's time to crunch numbers. And it's the same thing on player contracts. They're time-consuming and aggravating, it's not the best use of your time. Now, as GM, I still kept control of it. So if Dave Nonis is doing it, let's say Dave Nonis is working on Trevor London's contract, I still make the final call on what we pay him. But he does the grunt work on a series of phone calls and takes notes and all. It's just like Pat did. So I did every player contract when I worked for Pat. But Pat had final say on what we did, whether we moved or what happened next. So you want to have control of the process, but not put in the time.
Stanley Cup in Anaheim. Which trade did you make that really helped you get over the top?
In Anaheim? Okay, so if you talk about Anaheim, you got to talk about the two Murrays. It's not fair to talk about that team without talking about the two Murrays. First, Brian Murray, the late, great Brian Murray, who left so many important pieces on the board. Jiggy was there when I got there, J.S. Chiguer. Andy McDonald was there when I got there. Corey Perry and Ryan Getzlaff were there when I got there. Chris Kunitz was there when I got there. So we started with a bunch of important pieces on the chessboard. And Bob Murray, the assistant GM, was instrumental in filling in the rest of the chessboard. I say this all the time. Every time a team wins a cup, the assistant GM's name is on the cup. But I don't know an assistant GM who has a greater right to have his name on the cup than Bob Murray. Like, he was instrumental in a number of those deals. Like, he pushed me to get Travis Moen. He pushed me to get Francois Beauchemin. Like, Sean Thornton. These are all guys he really pushed me to get that I wasn't that big on. So the trade that put us over the top, I mean, people will point to the Chris Pronger deal in the summer of 06. And that's probably the history will regard that as that's what put us over the top. But I think that belittles Scott Niedermeyer a little bit, because I think that move a summer before, those two moves got to be ranked equally. And that wasn't a trade. That was a free agent signing. He was an unrestricted free agent from New Jersey. And signing him put us into contention. And Chris Pronger was probably the last piece that we needed. Once we got Chris Pronger, we started openly talking about winning the Stanley Cup.
Brian, Brad May was added later on in the year. You've always said he was an important part of the dressing room. What did he do to make himself that important?
Well, he does three things. Number one, he brings a positive energy to the room. And I talk about this a lot. Teemu Selanne was like that. Teemu never had a bad day in his life. We get beat 6-1. Teemu would come in the next day. Hey, we'll get these guys tomorrow night. Everything's good. Let's get a coffee. Let's get going here. Teemu never had a bad day. And we had some grumpy management people, including me and Bob Murray. We had a grumpy coach in Randy Carlyle. We had the grumpiest player, second grumpiest player ever in Chris Pronger. So to have guys in the room that were upbeat, that had a great value. So that's number one. Number two, he was tougher than a night in jail. So we added to our bottom six toughness, where if there was any doubt who the toughest team in the league was before we got Brad May, there wasn't any doubt after we got him. And then third, he actually can play. Like, the one thing about my toughness, people say, oh, you had a bunch of chain gang guys in the bottom six. Those guys could all play. George Parros could play. Like, on the nights when we didn't need them to fight, those guys chipped in. Sean Thornton could play. Brad May could play. So these were guys that added to our core strength in terms of the bottom six. Mayday added to that, but he also could play a little bit. And then he added those other two things, and leadership and positive attitude and the toughness. Everyone was afraid of Brad May.
Brian, I want to go back to a gentleman that had a great influence in your career, Lou Lamoriello. We actually interviewed him on the show about 3 years ago, and he was still with the Leafs. And I remember that interview like it was yesterday, because he schooled me really, really quickly at the beginning of the interview. And I learned a valuable lesson that day. But you learned a valuable lesson from Lou Lamoriello when you were at Providence College. I think you showed up late for a practice one time, and I believe you suffered some dire consequences. Got you up early in the morning. Tell us that story.
Yeah, it was Christmas Day, and we skated at 9 o'clock. And I'm a very early riser, and I go to bed very early. Like a typical night for me, not so much now when I'm working late nights doing TV and a normal schedule, but my typical schedule as a GM was in bed at 11, read till 11:30, get up at 5, go to bed at 11:30, get up at 5. And even in college, I went to bed early and got up early. And I think if you're a hunter or a fisherman, that's kind of your life. You know, like if you're a fisherman and you don't get up early, you're not going to catch enough fish. So same thing with duck hunting. You know, your best bet's being out there first thing. So I was late. I took some freshmen to midnight mass. So we didn't get to go home that year. We didn't get to go back to Minnesota or Canada, wherever you're from, because we were playing in a tournament. And so Christmas Eve, everyone was miserable and homesick. So I took three freshmen from Minnesota to midnight mass. There's a big Catholic church across the street from Providence College. I want to say St. Pius. And I took these three freshmen to midnight mass. So we got home around 1:30 and I went to bed. And I didn't wake up for practice, which was at 9 o'clock. So Lou, and it turned out later, Ronnie Wilson, who was my teammate, as a practical joke, turned off my alarm clock. So I would not have been late except for a prank. And I had to skate at 4 o'clock in the morning for 9 days with Lou. 9 days. But I was never late for anything since.
On the issue of what's going around now in terms of player behavior, which has been quite significantly on everybody's radar screen this week, coaching behavior. Has been discussed in the recent past. I believe we do now have a new coach's conduct reference from the NHL. A lot of the behaviors that perhaps wouldn't say were acceptable in the past, but maybe tolerated, are no longer. On that issue, Brett Hull said something controversial. How far back do we go on some of these things? I think we all appreciate, and I think we all understand what's acceptable conduct today and what's not acceptable. That's the easy part of it. But the proverbial statute of limitations on past conduct, what's your feelings on that?
Well, I was part of that interview. I can tell you what Brett Hull said was, yeah, we said a lot. He hadn't even seen what Leipzig said. He wasn't condoning any remarks of Brandon Leipzig. He was talking in general, like, it's different now. We said bad things. I've said that before publicly. My son was gay, but when I played, I used homophobic language all the time. I'm so embarrassed now. But you can't use a 2020 lens on conduct that occurred when I played in 1977. Was it reprehensible? Yes. Am I embarrassed? Yep. I apologized to my son so many times after he came out. I said, you can't believe how I used to talk. I'm so embarrassed. So Brett Hull had not seen the comments and just basically saying, yeah, we said dumb things too. And so everyone's saying, oh, he's condoning what Brandon Leipzig said, and it's only because of social media. That's not what he said. So, and the beauty of Brett Hull is he won't care anyway. He won't care anyway. He's never said anything offensive like that in the modern era when it's not acceptable. And so to me, the key here is when all this stuff started with Coach Peters and this junior hockey abuse and racial commentary, what I said on TV and what I meant was, if this is our Me Too moment, let's have it all out now. Let's bring it all to light. It's reprehensible. It's got to stop. Let's bring it all to light. And I was confident at that time there would not be a big, you know, a big parade of offenses and a large number of cases that we had to deal with. And I was right. It was a very small number because the game has evolved. And I was playing midget hockey, and I had a coach grab me by both shoulders and slam me into the chicken wire fence, or the chain link fence that we had in our rink. We didn't have glass. By both shoulders, and physically slam me as hard as he could in and yell at me. My parents were there. My mom wasn't happy, but my dad was like, what did you do? Why'd you make the coach so mad? I was there when Mark Crawford kicked Brent Sopel. I told Brent Sopel afterwards, you're lucky I wasn't on the bench, or you'd have got kicked twice. But I made Mark Crawford apologize to him in person and on the ice in front of the whole team. It's not appropriate. But these things change. Remember when Woody Hayes grabbed a player by the throat on an opposing team? Like, these things change. And so what's acceptable today will be different in the year 2040. It'll continue to evolve, and there'll be a different standard and a different microscope. And it might go backwards. Who knows? But the point is, this stuff has no place in our game. Racial commentary or any kind of racial discrimination, any kind of comments about women that are inappropriate, any kind of physical abuse, they have no place in our game. come forward if they happen. People come forward, and we'll deal with them. I'm not worried about it. I think our game has cleaned itself up nicely.
Brian, there's a good chance the NHL will get back at play. Do you feel the younger teams have a better chance because of the layoff over the veteran teams?
You know what? I'm not so sure we're going to get back to play. I hope you're right. I'm more hopeful than I ever was with each passing day. I said from the get-go we weren't going to play. I still think there are significant obstacles, although I am encouraged by a little wrinkle, and this is the lawyer in me. They say that the UFC event went ahead last night, even though one fighter tested positive. So you would think they'd say we have to quarantine all the fighters and the handlers and everyone had access to this fighter, but they didn't. They went ahead and did the event. And that's not what the health experts have said. They've said if one player tests positive, they've all got to quarantine. So I'm curious about that. I hope I'm wrong. I've said from the get-go it's going to be hard to play. I think we're reopening too soon in some of the states. And I foresee continuing problems with testing and availability stuff, but I love the league's attitude. I love the NHL. Gary Bettman and Bill Daly have had the right mindset on this from day one, which is if there's any human way to play, we're playing, and we will have the scenarios ready. I love that. I love their determination to play. So if we get the green light, we're going to play. I just think there's still a lot of obstacles that people haven't even dreamed of. And I do think when we do come back, I think we're coming back to a real different economic landscape than we left.
One other area that I've always admired about you is that you speak your mind. You're not scared to hold back, and I've always considered that a really positive character trait. And that's to state the obvious. And the one area you're not fearful about stating your criticisms. You've been critical of media coverage in Toronto. You have some, obviously, if it's positive, you're more than happy to pat people on the back if for positive, but you've been critical of certain media coverage. You still feel the same way?
I've never patted anyone on the back.
Okay.
And I never will. The beauty of my position on television is I haven't made any deals with anybody. So what happens when you're in the media for a while, you establish alliances with agents and with certain GMs, and it's kind of like you're not going to rip that GM because he's your buddy. Well, I'm trying to be objective on every single thing I do. So if I don't like a signing, I didn't like Auston Matthews' contract. I said that. I like Auston Matthews as a player immensely. But I didn't like the contract, and I said that. I don't like the NHL draft lottery. And people say, oh, you're tight with Bettman. Yeah, I am tight with Bettman. But I think the NHL draft lottery is a joke, and I've said that many times. So I'm going to speak my mind. Now, here's what I said about the media in Toronto, in case you weren't paying attention. I think the vast majority of the media that cover the NHL are honest, hardworking, sincere people that want to get it right. No question about it. And we're the beneficiaries of that. I said this back as an assistant GM in Vancouver. I said at the time, but there's a handful of scumbags and maggots that get it wrong and wreck it for everybody. Now, that quote's been used against me 100 times, that I called the media scumbags and maggots. I didn't. I said the media as a group are wonderful, but there's a handful. And I've gone after those people by name. I've sued a couple of them. I will continue to go after them by name. My view hasn't changed. Here's the issue with the media in Toronto. It's the sheer volume. So in Calgary, after practice on a nine-game day, we might have 20 reporters and maybe three cameras. After a game, 40 reporters and five cameras. After a game in Toronto, there's close to 100 people in that room. That's why the dressing room is so big. I don't know if you guys know that. The reason NHL dressing rooms are so big is for the media. It's not for the players. We'd like to have smaller rooms. We'd like to have the dressing room, the walls be 10 feet apart, so or 12 feet apart, like back when we played, so you can make eye contact with a guy and talk to him without shouting. The rooms are that big to accommodate the media. So when you lose in Toronto, it's 80 people or 90 people picking up a rock and throwing it. So it's 10 at Phil Kessel, 10 at me, 10 at Dion, 10 at Ron Wilson. And there's an overwhelming negativity that accompanies that with the social media. That's all I've said. I've never used it as an excuse. As I said, the day I got fired, I did my press conference 3 days later. I said, I was fired here because I didn't win enough games. didn't make any excuses. People don't like being accountable. I don't mind being accountable.
Brian,
you mentioned Dion Phaneuf. What makes him so unpopular with the Leafs? I've never seen a player so unpopular than he was with Toronto.
Well, you remember Larry Murphy?
Yeah.
I think the crowd here turns on one guy. They were turning on Jake Gardner at the end, too. I think the crowd here picks a whipping boy, and that guy can do nothing right. In Dion's case, I also think Canadians despise athletes they view as overpaid. Like, Americans are accustomed to it, right? They're used to, well, this guy in football makes $20 million this year, so they're not getting mad at Zdeno Chara or Pasternak, who's making $8 million. They're kind of immune to it because hockey salaries aren't offensive compared to the other sports. But in Canada, people resent big salaries unless you're playing great. Like, the accountability level for money in Canada is much higher than it is in the U.S., and that's what bothered people, is that he made a lot of money. He was a great player for us. He played well. He was a good captain, good teammate. He's a wonderful human being. But they turned on him, I think, more because of the money, and the team didn't win. He's the captain of a team that can't win. They turned on him. I mean, Larry Murphy got run out of this place, and Larry Murphy's a great player and went on to have some great seasons elsewhere. So to me, I think one thing, too, they did a show on Dion. I forget what it was. The NHL encouraged, there was a player's cribs, and Dion gave a tour of his house and showed his suits and his watches, and that just drove people crazy. They don't want to see how many, I don't even know, what's the name of a designer? I don't have any. They want to see any Armani suits. You've got 10 Armani suits and 3 Rolexes, and you know, people are like, no, some guy just got his weed off in Alberta. He ain't worried about how many watches a player has. He doesn't like that.
Brian, I hope you can give us about another 3-4 minutes. And we may be a little bit, we'll try and wrap this up shortly. I've just got a couple of quick questions. Today's NHL, a word that you like to use, that I like to use as well, is truculent. Doesn't seem... A lot of people are critical of today's NHL. A lot of skill, not as much physicality. How do we get the physicality back into the game?
Well, the one good thing is, the one thing that I really like about our league is it's kind of cyclical, or cyclical, if you use the proper definition or proper pronunciation. It's kind of a cyclical deal where we'll get a little run, like it'll be flag football for about 3 weeks, and then there'll be one big hit in the game and a couple of fights, and then we'll get a little run of like 10, 12 games where it's more like that. And then it calms down again, and you get a little run, and you get excited again. The game is in great shape. The players have never been better. The speed is fantastic. I love the game. I miss that one component. And what encourages me is that it always seems to come back in vogue in the playoffs. And that restores my faith in hockey and where we are. But I watch the Leafs a lot. When we're doing the games, I'm in studio. But when we're not, if the Leafs are playing and we're not doing the game, I'm at the game. I love their talent. I love their skill level. I don't like their level of truculence or physicality. And I do think the game misses that. And the one thing that restores my faith in the game every year is the playoffs, because it comes in game one. The intensity level ratchets up in the first game of each series.
Naz, one last question each. Go ahead.
Nazem Kadri was traded in the offseason. Do you think they should have kept him instead of making the trade?
Well, I think what went into it, first off, my three rules of broadcasting are, one, I assume basic competence. So I assume that Kyle Dubas is basically a competent guy, and he is. He's very bright. Two is, I assume good intentions. I assume he wants to win as badly as all Leaf fans do, which he does. And three, I assume superior knowledge. In other words, I can pry and I can dig and I can look into what's happening in the Leafs dressing room, but Kyle's always going to know better than I do. So that trade to me was, I think the players felt they could not trust Naz after what had happened in the playoffs 2 years in a row, getting suspended in the playoffs 2 years in a row. I think he lost his teammates' trust. So that went into it. The salary cap went into it. And the players that came back at the time, people are questioning that deal now because Tyson Berry hasn't performed as people expected. And Alex Kerfoot's a nice player, but hasn't done a whole lot. People are questioning the payoff now, but at the time I thought it was a good return. And the fact is, some players can't play in Toronto. Some players can't handle a big stage, but I thought it was a good return. And so I wouldn't criticize that trade because I'm guessing I've had teammates come to me before and say, players come to me before and say, look, this guy's got to go. We don't trust him. And so, and that happens. And I think that's what happened here. And when that happens, you have to move on.
Last question, Brian, personal curiosity from my point of view. You are a voracious reader. You carry books around with you all the time. You carry them on airplanes. You've made it an important part of your family's upbringing. What's your favorite book or books?
I think my favorite book of fiction is Sometimes a Great Notion by Ken Kesey, and it's old, but it's a fantastic book about the Stamper family. And I loved that book, and a guy I played with actually got Ken Kesey to autograph a copy of it for me. I'm not sure where that is with all these moves I've gone through, but I read mostly, I'm a history major. I read mostly biographies of famous people, politicians. I try to read every fifth book I read. I try and read a sports book, but it's tricky because I don't want to read a book that I don't want to read a book unless it's written by someone with a ring. Like, I don't want to learn how to be good at this. I don't want to learn how to be good at something. I want to learn how to be great at something. So it's, I do read a lot of biographies. Right now I'm reading River Battles, which my children gave me for Christmas. It's about the river battles in World War II. I'm just starting it up. I just finished Edison, which they also gave me a book about Thomas Alva Edison. I knew nothing about him, and it was a fascinating read.
Anyways, Brian, hopefully we haven't overstayed our welcome. I just want to thank you so much for this. It's been very interesting. We appreciate so much you taking the time for us on a Sunday morning, and we will continue to watch you on Sportsnet. We always find you interesting and passionate. Thanks so much for taking your time for us.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
It's our pleasure. On that note, Naz, we've got about 6-7 minutes left. We'll go to break, and Naz and I will be back to wrap it up.
It was a rainy day when Pizzaville introduced contact-free delivery. Order and prepay online and choose contact-free delivery. The driver will place your order on your doorstep in a nice, clear, protective bag. Then he'll politely stand back 2 metres and call the number on the receipt. Once you answer the door, he'll give you a little toodaloo and off he goes. Contact-free delivery from pizzaville.ca or the Pizzaville app.
This is Daryl Sittler for Alta Infinity and Vaughn. I've worked with some pretty great teams over the years, and the staff at Alta ranks among the very best. Expert sales, superior service, and the largest selection of Infinity cars and SUVs in Canada, and the most competitive pricing anywhere. It's no wonder that Alta has been an all-star performer for well over a decade. Visit AltaInfinityWoodbridge.com, or better yet, drop by the No. 7 Auto Mall at the corner of Martin Grove and Highway 7. Experience the difference that makes Alta Infinity the captain's choice.
To become a champion in business, it takes coaching, training, and bench strength. And every team needs a skilled player like KPMG Enterprise for private companies. KPMG Enterprise helps entrepreneurs and family businesses grow, strengthen, and transition by offering a full suite of services, including audit, accounting, tax, and advisory. Your business doesn't stand still. It evolves. Team up with a winner. Visit kpmg.ca/enterprise. Let's do this.
The security business is easy, right? Anyone can learn it. Perhaps they can learn it on duty with your valuables at stake. Perhaps they can learn it in a crisis situation that requires an immediate intelligent response when lives are at risk. After all, what harm can a few mistakes make? Plenty. When it comes to security for your business or office, an experienced partner like Regal Security makes sense. Security is what they do. Peace of mind is what they provide. Visit them online at regalsecurity.ca and find out how much they know, not how much they can learn.
Are you real ready?
If you're a real estate agent, we can help you sell more homes. A business owner? We'll help show it off to the community at large. And if you're a homeowner, we'll supply accurate floor plans for every room in your home. Because selling property is all in the details. Real Tours Media, creators of 3D virtual tours, walkthrough video, HDR photography, logos, and brands. Check out the one-stop shop for successful real estate agents. RealToursMedia.ca.
There's an old saying, entrepreneurship doesn't build character, it reveals character. Entrepreneurs learn to trust a person by trusting people. The law firm Rigabon Carly understands this. They know all about entrepreneurs because they work for them. Every day, they've earned their trust. They know that when it comes to meeting the legal and business needs of entrepreneurs, good enough is not enough. Rigabon Carly, the intelligent choice.
Are they ever wrong about sports? I can answer that in two words. Impossible. The Naz and Wally Sports Hour on Zoomer Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to the Naz and Wally Sports Hour. I'm your host, Walter Rigabon. On the line with me, my co-host, Naz Marchese. Naz, I enjoyed that Brian Burke interview. I find him, you know, that commercial about the most interesting man in the world. I've always found Brian Burke, if not pretty close to being the most interesting man in hockey. He's a straight shooter. He's not scared to tell you what's on his mind. He's got principles. He's got character. He's got values. And they certainly come through. And he's got that stubborn Irish streak in him as well. Certainly very, very interesting. Pleasure to chat with him. Naz?
Yeah, he was very level-headed, and it was a great interview.
Yeah, no, I'm sure he doesn't need to hear that from us. But he's there's very few people. You know, you and I have been around a long time, and we've been associated not on a professional level, but we've been sports junkies since we were kids, and always had a fascination with sports and sports media. Did our own show in the 1970s, call-in show. Took this back up six years ago, and always had a passion for sports. And like when we've discussed, a lot of our contemporaries have been shown the proverbial door in the last year or so, and we don't need to get into names, some of whom we've interviewed on the show in the last few weeks. There's very few in sports talk radio or in sports media these days that I will go out of my way that I find tremendously entertaining or tremendously insightful. But if I see Brian Burke's persona on the television screen or I hear his voice on the radio, I turn up the dial.
And so do I. He's very honest and very opinionated, and his stories are amazing.
Yeah, and we only scratched the surface of them. I wish we had more time. There's a great Brian Burke story between him and Kevin Lowe and the whole Dustin Penner fiasco, where they literally almost challenged each other to a fist fight that was supposed to happen, and Gary Bettman had to pick up the phone and say to Brian, "You're kidding, right?" And Brian said he was kidding. Yeah, couldn't get into that. Couldn't get into. I got the opportunity to listen to some of the other interviews he's done and some of the other sports media outlets lately. Worst contract he would say was J. Michael Lyles. That's a fascinating story. Character, the Neil Yakupov story, when they interviewed Neil Yakupov before the draft. This was the Morgan Riley draft, I believe, where Burke actually had Riley at number one, and I think Riley went 4 or 5 that year, if I'm not mistaken.
He went five.
Which certainly, in retrospect, that was a hell of a good draft, hell of a good choice. But interesting story about the Yakupov interview before that draft, and didn't have time for that Burke story, unfortunately. So many other stories Brian Burke could tell us. Hopefully there's a book in his future Certainly, if Brian Burke writes a book, I'd probably be the first one to pick it up and flip through it. There's so much, you know, not scared to be critical. As soon as they signed Nylander, they overpaid him. Did not quite understand, couldn't make the math work with the four big contracts in Toronto. And the beauty of it all, Brian Burke's not scared to discuss it.
I remember Brian saying he'd let Knight Nylander rot in that contract dispute.
Yeah, he's not vindictive. He's fair. He's fair in his criticism. He makes his point, and he's willing to stick up for his point. And on that note, unfortunately, Naz, the clock has struck 10. Last words.
Just want to wish happy Mother's Day to my mother-in-law, Terry Danilo. Special to all of us.
Thanks to our listeners. Have a safe week. We'll be back again next Sunday morning.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.